Hi there, and welcome to Swiss Info's program for October 4th. I'm Veronica Devorin-Byrne.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note.
World War II started 75 years ago, and World War I a century ago. Today, we'll go back in time to wartime in neutral Switzerland. From a hotel crawling with spies, to smugglers helping Jewish families to safety. But first, I sat down with my colleague Tom Stevens, who's become Swiss Info's de facto World War correspondent. I asked him to take me back to the outbreak of World War I in Switzerland, 100 years ago.
Well, it was a dynamic little country. It didn't have the banking situation that played a role during the Second World War, that's true. But it was one of the most highly industrialized countries in Europe at the time, and things were looking good.
It didn't take long after the war broke out for Switzerland to be basically flooded with propaganda. Where was it coming from, and why did the influencers want to bother with neutral Switzerland?
Neutral little Switzerland. Well, the propaganda was coming from all sides. Since the beginning of the 20th century, there had been linguistic tension in Switzerland between, on the one hand, the French and Italian-speaking part of the country, who had been feeling increasingly distant from the German-speaking majority, who had been looking up to the big, powerful German neighbour. When war broke out in 1914, both sides, the Allied powers and the Central powers, they were aware of this linguistic tension, and they used this to basically wage a propaganda war on, as you say, tiny, neutral Switzerland, on a scale that had never been seen before. Indeed, the First World War was basically the first mass media war. How did they do this? They used every single tool at their disposal, from newspapers, magazines, posters, leaflets, to newsreels in cinemas, advertising, and even children's games and books. They flooded the country to try to win Swiss hearts and minds, to convince the neutral Switzerland that what they were doing was legitimate and justified, and also to try to get them on their side.
That was Swiss Info journalist Tom Stevens, who's been digging through archives and propaganda materials to try to understand more about Switzerland at the outbreak of World War I, 100 years ago. You can read more about that time in Swiss history at swissinfo.ch. Next to the Parliament building in Switzerland's peaceful capital of Bern sits a 5-star hotel which, on a clear day, has a spectacular view of the Alps. That's also where it gets its name, the Bellevue. Today, you might see tourists having a coffee on the terrace, taking in the scenery, or a businessman talking on his phone in the lobby. But a closer look at the hotel's history reveals it as a hotbed of political activity starting at the outbreak of World War I in 1914 and continuing into the Cold War era. I have a personal connection to the hotel. My grandparents met there right after World War II, and so I wanted to know more about what had happened in that building over the years. So I paid a visit to Martin Fröhlich at his apartment outside Bern. He's an architectural historian who helped plan the most recent reconstruction of the hotel and wrote a book about it for its 100th anniversary last year. In 1913, the year the modern-day Bellevue was built, Switzerland was developing its tourism infrastructure. Architects included some of the most modern elements of the day in hotels like the Bellevue to attract tourists. Its plumbing system was so technologically advanced that some of it is still used today, and it even has an early form of air conditioning. But after war broke out, the hotel's role changed completely to accommodate one very important guest, Fröhlich told me.
In the First World War, Mr. Ulrich Wille from Zurich was named as a general. He lived before in Bern. He was chief of the cavalry, and that time was very important. And so as chief of the army, he decided to make the hotel as his headquarters. And in the morning at 7:30, I don't know exactly when, he came from his own house to the bureau in the Bellevue, and he was then the general, and in the evening he went back to his wife. And so Wille could manage the whole army as he wanted. He was the chief. So Bellevue became headquarters.
In the period between the two world wars, the Bellevue was once again looking to attract new visitors, as tourism had turned dismal after the First World War. The 1930s saw more renovations, but then things changed again. Here's how Fröhlich tells it.
Second World War. General was General Guisan from the Lake of Geneva, French-speaking part of Switzerland. He decided to have his headquarters as distant as possible from the government. For him, the army was another thing than the government. He never had a headquarters in Bern. So the city of Bern was exempted from the army, and therefore I was told the famous Bellevue Bar was the only place in Europe where the Nazis and the Allied could speak together. They were just guests in the hotel bar. That's, I guess, the only important part that the Bellevue played during the Second World War. Also, during the Cold War, that rule of the Bellevue Bar remained.
Before he wrote his book on the Bellevue, Froelich was asked by the then hotel director, Mr. Vindelin, to help analyze and categorize all the old paintings, decorations, and architectural features of the hotel, down to what type of marble was used when the building was first constructed in 1913. But he told the hotel director he didn't want any money for his work.
No, no money. I need a credit of you in your house for coming to eat and coming to sleep and to enjoy all the accommodations you have in your wonderful hotel. Oh, okay, that's nice. We do it. And so I had for 3-4 years when I was wanted to go to the hotel, I made a phone call. Mr. Winley and I come then and then. Oh, it's okay, it's wonderful you come. We have seen you not a long time. And so on. So I was a little bit part of the hotel. You see, I was really a friend of that building. As long as Mr. Windlin lived, he died in the springtime of 2006. And then it was another regime, other persons, other style. I never did go back to the hotel.
That was Martin Froelich, an architectural historian who recently wrote a book on Bern's Hotel Bellevue. While spies were rendezvousing at the Bellevue Bar, others were risking their lives in dangerous people smuggling operations along Switzerland's borders. Daniel Johnson has the story of the last surviving Swiss smuggler from World War II.
Frenchman Bernard Bouveret was no more than 16 years old when the Swiss intelligence service recruited him to work in occupied France in 1941, 2 years after the Second World War broke out. It was highly illegal and dangerous work. We transported grenades, gunpowder and microfilm, lots of microfilm, Bouveret remembers. In 1942 and 1943, we smuggled lots of people. We took resistance fighters across, Jews and others on the run who needed to reach Switzerland to save their skin. That was our work. As a fit young woodcutter who grew up next to the vast Rizhu forest, Bouveret had the ideal cover. But it wasn't easy. He had to work during the daytime and then carry out his secret activities at night, all under the noses of the German soldiers garrisoned in his village of Chapelle des Bois in France. At first, Bouveret was tasked with reporting on enemy troop movements, but he was soon carrying precious information from the French resistance that was meant for the British consulate in Lausanne and then for General de Gaulle in London.
Toujours de nuit, et puis été comme hiver, même en ski, on passait en ski là.
We always crossed at night, summer and winter. We'd even use our skis, Bouveret says.
Faut dire, deux jours, ils nous arrêtaient, mais ils contrôlaient les papiers, mais de nuit, ils tiraient sans sommation.
If the Germans stopped you in the daytime, they'd check your papers. But if it was after the 11 p.m. curfew, they'd shoot on sight. A friend of mine was killed at 4 a.m. after being hit in the knee with an explosive round. He died in the snow. It's now reckoned that hundreds of people crossed from France into Switzerland through Rizhu Forest's 200-kilometer-long stretch. They owed their lives to just 15 or so French and Swiss smugglers, known locally as passeurs. Among those who fled, many were children.
And this is Adi Nussbaum, one of my closest friends, who was the first one whom the passeur led across the Rizou.
Wartime survivor Walter Reed looks through an old photo album showing his childhood friends in occupied France who fled the Nazis across the Rizou forest.
That's Manfred Kamlet. He was led across together with a girl named Edith Moser across the Rizou. And his older brother, Walter Kamlet, was the last one, together with two other people, who was led across the Rizou by these people.
Although those making the crossing often had little to lose, Rizou Forest was far from a safe haven. That's because Swiss customs officers had orders to arrest any fugitives they found at the border and send them back. In fact, refugees had to get at least 10 kilometres inside Swiss territory before they could register to stay here for the remainder of the war. Fugitives had to hide with sympathetic families first, before being put on a train and sent further into Switzerland so they could finally seek asylum. More than 70 years after these events, a group of walkers gathers in the forest to remember the Rizou smugglers. They're going to retrace one of the easier routes taken through the forest during the war. The event is the brainchild of a local association, Les Passeurs de Mémoire. Their secretary, Joel Raymond.
Alors, pour la plupart d'entre vous, donc on va traverser la forêt, on commence ici sur Suisse, et redescendre après sur France. Temps de marche, 2 heures environ.
The walk will take at least 2 hours to cross the forest into France, Raymond tells the walkers. He reminds them that the smugglers made the journey 4 or 5 times a week in 1943, at night, and whatever the weather. That last piece of information isn't lost on the younger walkers here today.
Bonjour. Tu peux imaginer faire ce parcours en pleine nuit?
Non.
Pourquoi?
Parce que déjà la nuit faut dormir. Et puis c'est trop long.
Can you imagine doing this crossing? I ask one girl in the group. No, she replies. Nights are for sleeping and it's too long as well.
T'es pas fatigué?
Are you tired, I ask.
Ah si.
For Bernard Bouveret and his fellow smugglers, there wasn't much rest, and there wasn't much money in it either, although many people believed that he'd made a fortune from selling wartime contraband. Bouveret denies that, but it was a difficult accusation to dodge, and one of the reasons why so little was known about the work of the smugglers until stories started to emerge in the 1990s. Joel Raymond explains.
If you got caught having chocolate and tobacco, stuff like that on you, you were a smuggler. And you got fined. And you needed that because if the Germans caught you with nothing, or even worse, with documents, there would be interrogations, torture, and maybe a death camp. So they had to smuggle stuff. And they also did smuggle, they were helping, they were real smugglers, you know, they were helping the populations who were so deprived. But that's the reason why people would turn back against them afterwards. They think that they had gotten rich during the war with this activity, not knowing that underneath that, there was some real resistance, helping people, saving lives.
Bouveret's covert activities ended when the Gestapo caught up with him in 1943. They sent him to Dachau concentration camp, where he stayed until the Americans freed him in 1945, 6 months after the war ended.
À la une, à la deux, et à la trois, allez-y.
Wow.
A lakeside memorial is unveiled to commemorate this hidden history and recognise the secret role played by ordinary young men and women in Rizou who saved lives during the last war. The idyllic Vallée de Joux is better known for its watchmaking than resistance fighting, but now there's an opportunity to change that forever.
That's all for this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Devorin-Byrne.